Blog Talk Radio.
Divine Healing Night, and we're talking about Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Hi, Dr. King was pushed into a lot of stuff. How Dr. King was the drum major for peace, and how Dr. King know after John F. Kennedy got killed, he know that he could be killed because of the evil that went on in America. I want to thank you on this Saturday for coming to Divine Healing. I want to thank you for calling and being involved in what we talk about, the true things that went on. I want to share with you tonight Dr. Clarence Jones, who was the doctor, who was a lawyer, was Dr. King's speechwriter, and also was Dr. King, was did a whole lot. This whole month, we're honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. as a peacemaker, drum major for justice, a man that turned this country around. He did more for this country than Abraham Lincoln. He did more for this country than the Constitution. He did more for this country than the Kennedys. I feel Dr. King was the walking Constitution. Dr. King was the man that set things in order. And I just feel that Dr. King was a prophet in his own way and was gifted to bring us, to open our eyes to the truth and justice that's going on today. So it's important for you and me to understand where we go from here. In the valley of dry bones, in the valley of negativity, in the valley of hate, out of that valley got to come some love. All of that, out of that valley got to come some joy. Out of that valley got to come some peace. And we're praying tonight for divine healing for each one that listening and each one that get involved. I want you to look at the power of prayer. And on Sunday, it's Sunday morning with the bishop. And
first met Dr. King and how he last ruptured all this.
I met Dr. King when I was 29 years old. It's the first week in February, I believe, 1960. And he was 31. The occasion for the meeting was a telephone call I had received from a Hubert Delaney, who was a judge, Hubert Delaney, in New York, who had known me and had been helpful to me in making a recommendation for me to get into law school early admission so I wouldn't have to wait another year. I was trying to go to Columbia Law School, but they said, no, positions are filled and you have to wait another year, and I don't want to do that since I'd already been in the United States Army. And through the end of the Korean War for 2 years, and I was, you know, I want to go and get on with my life after I got out of the Army in 1955. In any event, so he called me, he says, Clarence, he says, I am the chief counsel of this Negro preacher, you know, this preacher in Alabama, and Martin Luther King Jr., Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. I said, yes, I heard of him. He said, well, he's been indicted by the state of Alabama for tax evasion. And perjury, lying on his state income tax return, and that I have, as part of my defense team, two very able, distinguished Negro tax lawyers from Chicago, Robert Ming and Robert Layton. One of them, I don't remember which one, was actually the lawyer for the Illinois Department of Internal Revenue Service, encyclopedic on federal and state taxes. And then I have a young man in Montgomery by the name of Fred Gray. All very able lawyers, but what I really need, Clarence, I would like for you to help me. I'd like for you to be my law clerk. I'd like for you to help in the preparation of the defense of the case. And when he first spoke with me, I thought he was talking about doing research. Now, this is February 1960. And I didn't really think about it, but I figured, well, you know, I'd go into a research in a library and I would just send it to him. Special delivery, didn't have any internet. I don't even recall whether we had fax machines. But anyway, I knew what I would. And he said, no, that's not going to work. So you need to go down there. And when he described in detail what he was, in fact, requesting me to do, and I said, Judge, I am so sorry, but I simply cannot do that. And he was very disappointed in me, and it was very difficult for me to say no to him. That was on a Thursday evening. The next morning, very early, I get a call from Judge Laney again, only this time he says, I did not know it at the time of our conversation last night, Clarence, Thursday night. Dr. King is in the air now. He's on his way to Los Angeles. He has a speaking engagement. And then he's going to be speaking as a guest speaker in the Baptist church over in a colored neighborhood somewhere in Los Angeles. But I told him to take advantage of the change in time that he's going to land about 11:45 your time. And I told him the very first thing he should do. Just rent a car, come out and see. I was living in a suburb outside of Los Angeles, Altadena, California. So I'm thinking to myself, oh no, but I already told the judge, you know, I couldn't go down to Montgomery, Alabama, so I didn't know how I could credibly say I wouldn't agree to meet Dr. King. Now, as I say when I tell this story, and I've told it on more than one occasion, in 1960, Dr. King was very popular. Aside from having been identified with the success and earlier, 4 or 5 years earlier when the Montgomery bus boycott, he had also been on the cover picture story of Time, Look, and Life magazine. So when I told my wife at the time, who is now deceased, that Martin Luther King Jr. was coming to our home, you would have thought that in 2017 terms, that an amalgamation of Michael Jackson, George Clooney, Matthew McConaughey, I can't think of the fences. The other great black actor.
Denzel
Washington, thank you. And come contemporary stars. You think that was what was coming to our home. Thursday evening, walking to our home, the bell rings. Got a bell there, you're standing there. Coming to the house. There's a company by Richard Lee. Traveling with him.
No.
But look.
My wife
is recording.
Snacks, some coffee, sit around the coffee table. After some initial pleasantries, he leans forward on the coffee table, puts his hands on the coffee table, leans forward, closer to me, and he says, you know, Lawyer Jones, Attorney Jones, he says, you know, we have lots of white lawyers from the Midwest, from the Northeast, to help us with our cause. But what we need, Mr. Jones, are young Negro lawyers like you to help me and our people as we're struggling for freedom in the South. So I said, Dr. King, as I said to Vetsalini, I wish I could help you, but I simply cannot help you with me going down to Montgomery, Alabama. And then he began to tell me in a little more detail of what he was seeking to do and what he was doing. And I listened, and he asked me some questions about myself, you know. And I told him about the only child of living domestic household servants. I lived with my parents on and off before I was 6 years of age, and then I lived with them in the service quarters of the household of the people for whom they worked. My mother, a maiden clerk, my father, a chauffeur in a bar. I told them all that. And then at the age of six, thereabouts, my mother principally decided to put me in a Catholic boarding school founded by a woman's sister, Catherine Drexel, member of the Drexel family, a Philadelphia, very wealthy family. And apparently she took a part of her trust that she shared with her brother, also named Drexel, founded the Drexel Institute and other things. And she funded this school that had a plaque on the outside of the doors called a school for indigent, meaning poor, didn't know it at the time, indigent colored boys, and Indians, meaning Indians, young boys who were from the reservations in New Mexico and Arizona, because they apparently had mission schools. So that's what I, they placed me there from the age of six until 14, and I stayed there most of the time, except during the summers, when I would spend time with my parents, wherever they were. And I told them that. And I also told them that one of the most painful experiences in my life was the death of my mother when I was in my third year in college. My mother saw me graduate as valedictorian from a public high school in Palmyra, New Jersey. Never saw me graduate from college. Never saw me graduate from law school. Had one baby daughter at the time. Never saw her daughter, never saw her grandchild. And that was, you know, it was very painful for me, you know. And I also told them that when my mother died, I was taking an examination on January 8th, 1952, the date of my birthday at Columbia College. And the proctor taps me on the phone and says, are you Clarence Jones? I said, yes. There's an emergency call for you. And they have so quick. He said, well, why don't you finish your essay? Finish your work. So I finish my part examination, and I go into the office of the dean at Columbia College. I said, yes, you have to call the hospital and they're missing. I finally reached my father that they had operated on my mother that day, early that day, January 8th, for colon cancer. And the cancer, they used the words, the doctor's words, it spread so much and so severely that they had to remove her bowel tract inside of her body. Put it outside. Colonoscopy, I didn't understand any of that at the time. Just, they were dramatic in their description of what they had to do. And very clinically, they said she probably has 3 to 4 months to live maximum, if that. That's what my birthday present. January 1952. I got myself together and quickly went down. Anyway, so I told Dr. King that. And there's a lot of things. He leaves. At which point, my wife turns to me in a somewhat, not somewhat, in a critical, almost sarcastic voice and says, what do you think you are doing that's so important that you can't come, but you can't go and help this man that came all this distance, that's for your assistance. And so as I said on other occasions, I got into what can best be described as my lawyer's, young lawyer's bag. I simply said, Anne, her name, that is the police doctor's name, I'm sure. He has big engagement this weekend in Los Angeles, and Judge Delaney thought that since he was going to be out of here, that he should take advantage of being out of here and come to see me, but he did not come out here specifically to ask for my help. And then I added in a kind of anger at her and angry at the situation. And besides, aside, just because a Negro preacher got his hand caught in a cookie jar stealing, that ain't my problem. And if he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't have been indicted. She says, I don't believe you. Your lawyer, how can you talk that way? I said, that's the way I feel. So as my first book was What Would Martin Say? And as I described this instance in the first chapter, that was a cold night in the Jones household that night. She was pissed at me. Right? So, that was a Friday night. The next morning, very early in the morning, also California time, I answer the phone. My voice on the other end of the phone is just dripping sweet saccharin, honey. Mr. Jones? Yes. My name is Dora McDonald. Yes. You know, Mr. Jones? Yes. You know, Dr. King, he enjoyed so much his visit with you and Mrs. Jones. But you know, Mr. Jones, he forgot. He forgot to invite you to be his guest tomorrow. He's preaching in the Baptist church, in his church in Baldwin Hills. He wanted to be sure that I reached you so that you could, your wife would come as a guest. And my wife is about 7 months pregnant at the time. And she says, well, you may not be going to Montgomery, Alabama, but you're going to that church. Still in a kind of belligerent mood. So I go to visit. I mean, I go to see Dr. King in this Baptist church in Tustin, then with Reverend D.B. Charles. I'd only been in Los Angeles for 7.5 months, but I quickly came to understand that Baldwin Hills at that time, if you were a Negro of any degree of financial success, a doctor, a lawyer, a business person, and you had money, you probably lived in Baldwin Hills. It was the equivalent of like white Beverly Hills or Bel Air. So I go to this Baptist church, the minister, son, name is Reverend H.B. Charles, but 13 of them are sitting about one-third of the pulpit. He's introduced by the resident minister, Dr. King gets up. And he says, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, the text of my sermon today is the role and responsibility of the Negro professional to aid our less fortunate brothers and sisters who settling for our freedom in the South. So I thought to myself immediately that this is one smart dude, that he was smart enough to come to this place where all these bourgeoisie, black bourgeoisie professionals were. He just could not have chosen a better audience to give his message. I repeat, I never seen or heard Martin Luther King Jr. speak before. And I should also add, I never heard any other human being with the attributes and characteristics of a human being with two arms and a leg walking around. I never heard anybody. His speech and his voice was mesmerizing. It was spellbinding. And he covered some of the things that he said to me across the table in my living room. My wife and I about what he was doing in the South. But in the sermon, it was filled with much more detail, much more texture, and much more power. And then, during the course of this powerful, mesmerizing speech, he says, for example, there's a young man sitting in this church today, my friends in New York, for whom I have great respect, my friends in New York, tell me, this young man, his brains have been touched by Jesus.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking, I mean, I don't think there's any rational relationship to me. I'm curious. They tell me that this young man, a young lawyer, that when he goes and does research on any problem, they tell me, in his research, he goes all the way back to the time of 1066 and William the Conqueror. And Magna Carta. So at that time, I began to pay a little attention to him because I'm thinking about, that's what I've spoken as this Baptist speaker. I didn't know anything about the history of English coming along. After all, my lawyer knows something about that. So I began to really pay attention. I said, this is a man who knows something, you know. And then he says, they further tell me that when he does his legal research, and he writes down what he finds on a page, the words are so compelling, they just jump off the page. Now, at that point, I then become very interested because knowing that it bears no rational description to me, I then begin to think opportunistically. I've only been qualified for 7.5 months. Whoever this young man is, he described, when this church service is over, I'm going to find out who he is, because if he's that good, he can be helpful to me. You know, he's got to be something, you know. So, and then he seamlessly went on. He said, you know, but I had a chance to meet this young man the other night in his home in Aberdeen, California, and I said to myself, oh, Lord. And I started trying to just make myself as small as I could in the pew in the church. Now, what I had told Dr. King in the discussion about myself and my parents being living domestic household services, what had happened to me, you know, it wasn't any state secret. But I didn't expect him to go repeat it to 1,300 strangers, so it was reminiscent of that hit song years ago by Roberta Flack, Killing Me Softly, with your songs. He was killing me softly, telling me this was thought about my life. And then he did something that was very unfair. He said, you know, his parents were living domestic household service. His mama was a maid and a cook and his father was a chauffeur. But he has forgotten once he came.
seems really obvious that when we think about children's learning, that we would also think about their health and their well-being, but that doesn't often happen in practice. Teachers College is one of the very few schools that actually does that.
And then there is an actual poem by Langston Hughes, a Negro poet and author. Caption, letter from mother to son. It's an actual poem. Now, in the poem that Langston Hughes wrote, it describes a Negro woman who is a domestic who's scrubbing Stanley's closet periodically. And she says, I'm doing this for you, son. Life ain't been no crystal stairs than what Dr. King did. He changed the lyrics and made my mother the actor in the poem and changed the lyrics like my mother was talking. But when he did that, I started crying. It was so powerful, tears up in there. Because I immediately saw like a video picture of my mother in her domestic uniform, civil uniform, my parents. I'm really disturbed. Church service is over. I said he was very popular. So he was standing outside of the church on the steps to the pulpit, signing autographs. And as I came into view, walking over to him, and he saw me, he says, you know, I never mentioned your name, Mr. Jones. I never mentioned your name. Sometimes we Baptist preachers, I never mentioned your name. I didn't say anything. I just kept walking. I walked over to him until I got to him. And I took my left arm and grabbed his right arm. I took my right hand and put it in his right hand and pulled him to me. Still a little teary-eyed, I said, Dr. King, when do you want me to go to Montgomery, Alabama? Well, that's what I call, in writing about it, and making him a disciple.
What happened with that tax evasion case?
The verdict came out in April 1960 in Montgomery, Alabama, before an all-white jury, an acquittal. Now think about it. Here is a controversial civil rights leader that gets acquitted by an all-white jury in Montgomery, Alabama. So when the jury was polled, and you found out that the reasons behind the acquittal, this is what the jurors lived in the community. And the two tax lawyers, they just destroyed, they wiped the floor with the government's tax. And it was clear in the published account from the trial that if somebody had bought this fucking fiction, they would look like a fool. They would have been people would say, I'm not an integrationist, I don't agree with anything Martin Luther King did, but I'm not dumb. I'm not a dummy. You know? And so he was acquitted by an all-white jury. And I remember him saying, we did it. And I said, no, we didn't do anything. I said, Judge Hubert Delaney and Fred Gray and those two tax lawyers, that's what they did. And I said, I want to try to get over. He said, no, you're my lucky rabbit, but you can't go. So we all said to them, going out and that swimming thereafter, before I could go back to New York. It was...
It's finally time for the President's Day sales event. Get behind...
That was extraordinary. That local citizens put their own pride of not being made a fool of over their racism. In that case, anyway. Now, I know you're probably going to ask me maybe some other questions about Martin Luther King Jr. and other questions about period of time. I'm 86. I didn't say it, but I'm 86, going on 87 years old in January. And, you know, there's an African proverb that says, if surviving lions don't tell their stories, the hunters will get all the credit. So I'm more than anxious to tell some of those stories. Martin Luther King Jr., to the extent that we will talk about him further and other people, I hate to burden you with the consequence of my also being a professor. I teach at the school. And when I teach students particular courses I created, for example, called From Slavery to Obama, Renewing the Promise of Reconstruction, and we get to that point in the course, which is a 15-week course for undergraduate students at the University of San Francisco, which I originally taught at Stanford University in the graduate school for students getting a master's degree in liberal arts. But when we get to that point in this political survey of slavery, institutional slavery, you can come in a doctrine of white supremacy, take it all up to the to Obama and pass. Okay? And we talk about the period in that journey when Martin Luther King Jr. in the 20th century comes on the scene. And I say to my students, I want them to have a very accurate remembrance of the position of Martin Luther King Jr. in the landscape and pantheon of American history. And this is the time I say to them, this is the only time during this course they come to my course with laptops and iPads and notebooks. I said, this is the only time I want you to write down every single word I'm about ready to say to you, because I don't want there to be any confusion. And I say, first of all, you should understand in the 20th century that Martin Luther King Jr. was the preeminent apostle of nonviolence, love, and the commitment to the pursuit of personal excellence. But in order for you to bracket his position in the pantheon and the journey of American history, this is what you must remember. In 12 years and 4 months, from 1956 until April 4th, 1968, the date of his assassination, with the exception of the presidency of Abraham Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation of 1863, Martin Luther King Jr. may have done more to achieve political, social, economic justice and access to economic opportunity and voting rights than any other person or event in the previous 400-year history of the United States. Translated in 2017,
they put 166.7% into everything they do.
This is banking, a fifth or better.
Your mattress shouldn't jiggle, because a mattress that jiggles is a mattress that transfers motion.
And I would see developments around there through various emperors and leaders, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the day of the Renaissance and get a quick picture of all that the Renaissance did for the cultural and aesthetic life of man, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even go by the way that the man for whom I'm named had his habitat. And I would watch Martin Luther as he tacked his 95 theses on the door at the Church of Wittenberg, but I wouldn't stop there. I would come on up even to 1863 and watch a vacillating president by the name of Abraham Lincoln finally come to the conclusion that he had to sign the Emancipation Proclamation, but I wouldn't stop there. I would even come up to the early 30s and see a man grappling with the problems of the bankruptcy of his nation, and come with an eloquent cry that we have nothing to fear but fear itself, but I wouldn't stop there. Strangely enough, I would turn to the Almighty and say, if you allow me to live just a few years in the second half of the 20th century, I will be happy. Now, that's a strange statement to make because the world is all messed up. The nation is sick. Trouble is in the land, confusion all around. That's a strange statement. But I know somehow that only when it is dark enough can you see the stars. And I see God working in this period of the 20th century in a way that men in some strange way are responding. Something is happening in our world. The masses of people are rising up, and wherever they are assembled today, whether they are in Johannesburg, South Africa, Nairobi, Kenya, Accra, Ghana, New York City, Atlanta, Georgia, Jackson, Mississippi, or Memphis, Tennessee, the cry is always the same, we want to be free. Another reason that I'm happy to live in this period is that we have been forced to a point where we are going to have to grapple with the problems that men have been trying to grapple with through history, but the demands didn't force them to do it. Survival demands that we grapple with them. Men for years now have been talking about war and peace, but now no longer can they just talk about it. It is no longer the choice between violence and nonviolence in this world. It's nonviolence or non-existence. That is where we are today. Also in the human rights revolution is something getting done and done in a hurry to bring the colored peoples of the world out of their long years of poverty, their long years of hurt and neglect. The whole world is doomed. Now, I'm just happy that God has allowed me to live in this period to see what is unfolding. And I'm happy that he's allowed me to be in Memphis. I can remember I can remember when Negroes were just going around, as Ralph has said so often, scratching where they didn't itch and laughing when they were not tickled. But that day is all over. We mean business now, and we are determined to gain our rightful place in God's world. And that's all this whole thing is about. We aren't engaged in any negative protests and in any negative arguments with anybody. We are saying that we are determined to be men. We are determined to be people. We are saying, that we are God's children. And that we are God's children, we don't have to live like we are forced to live. Now, what does all of this mean in this great period of history? It means that we've got to stay together. We've got to stay together and maintain unity. You know, whenever Pharaoh wanted to prolong the period of slavery in Egypt, he had a favorite formula for doing. What was that? He kept the slaves fighting among themselves. But whenever the slaves get together, something happens in Pharaoh's court, and he cannot hold the slaves in slavery. When the slaves get together, that's the beginning of getting out of slavery. Now let us maintain unity. Secondly, let us keep the issues where they are. The issue is injustice. The issue is the refusal of Memphis to be fair and honest in its dealings with its public servants who happen to be sanitation workers. Now we've got to keep attention on that. That's always the problem with a little violence. You know what happened the other day, and the press dealt only with the window breaking. I read the articles. They very seldom got around to mentioning the fact that 1,300 sanitation workers are on strike and that Memphis is not being fair to them, and that Mayor Loeb is in dire need of a doctor. They didn't get around to that. Now we're going to march again, and we've got to march again in order to put the issue where it is supposed to be. Force everybody to see that there are 1,300 of God's children here suffering, sometimes going hungry, going through dark and dreary nights, wondering how this thing is going to come out. That's the issue. And we've got to say to the nation, we know how it's coming out. But when people get caught up with that which is right, and they are willing to sacrifice for it, there is no stopping for it short of victory. man that may stop us. We are masters in our nonviolent movement in disarming police forces. They don't know what to do. I've seen them so often. I remember in Birmingham, Alabama, when we were in that majestic struggle there. We would move out of the 16th Street Baptist Church day after day. By the hundreds, we would move out, and Bill Connor would tell them to send the dogs for them. And they did come. But we just went before the dogs singing, "Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around." Bull Connor next would say, "Turn the fire hoses on." And as I said to you the other night, Bull Connor didn't know history. He knew a kind of physics that somehow didn't relate to the transphysics that we knew about. And that was the fact that there was a certain kind of fire that no water could put out. We went before the fire hose. We had known water. If we were Baptist or some other denomination, we had been immersed. If we were Methodist and some other, we had been sprinkled, but we knew water. That couldn't stop us. And we just went on before the dogs, and we would look at them, and we'd go on before the water hoses, and we would look at it. And we just go on singing, "Over my head, I see freedom in the air." And then we would be thrown into paddy wagons. And sometimes we would stack them there like sardines in a can. They would throw us in, and old Bull would say, "Take them off." And they did. And we would just go on in the paddy wagon singing, "We shall overcome." And every now and then we get in jail and we see the jailer looking through the windows, being moved by our prayer and being moved by our words and our songs. There was a power there which Bull Connor couldn't adjust to. And so we ended up transforming Bull into a steer, and we won our struggle in Birmingham. We've got to go on in Memphis just like that. I call upon you to be with us when we go out Monday. Now about injunctions. We have an injunction, and we're going into court tomorrow morning to fight this illegal, unconstitutional injunction. All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper. If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest our rights. So just as I say, we aren't going to let any dog or water hoses turn us around, we aren't going to let any injunction turn us around. We are going on. We need all of you. You know what's beautiful to me? Is to see all of these ministers of the gospel. It's a marvelous picture. Who is it that is supposed to articulate the longings and aspirations of the people more than the preacher? Somehow the preacher must have a kind of fire set up in his bones. And whatever injustice is around, he must tell it. Somehow the preacher must be an Amos. Said when God speaks, who can but prophesy? Again with Amos, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. Somehow the preacher must say with Jesus, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he has anointed me. And he's anointed me to deal with the problems of the poor. And I want to commend the preachers under the leadership of these noble men, James Lawson, one who has been in this struggle for many years. He's been to jail for struggling. He's been kicked out of Vanderbilt University for this struggling, but he's still going on fighting for the rights of his people. Reverend Ralph Saxon, Billy Kyle, I could just go right on down the list. Time will not permit, but I want to thank all of them. And I want you to thank them. Because so often, preachers are concerned about anything but themselves. And I'm always happy to see a relevant ministry. It's all right to talk about long white robes over yonder in all of its symbolism. But ultimately, people want some suits and dresses and shoes to wear down here. It's all right to talk about streets flowing with milk and honey. But God has commanded us to be concerned about the slums down here and his children who can't eat 3 square meals a day. It's all right to talk about the New Jerusalem, but one day God's preacher must talk about the new New York, the new Atlanta, the new Philadelphia, the new Los Angeles, the new Memphis, Tennessee. This is what we have to do. Now, the other thing we'll have to do is this. Always anchor our external direct action with the power of economic withdrawal. Now, we are poor people. Individually, we are poor when you compare with white society in America. We are poor. Never stop forget that collectively, that means all of us together, collectively we are richer than all the nations in the world with the exception of 9. Did you ever think about that? After you leave the United States, Soviet Russia, Great Britain, West Germany, France, and I can name others, the American Negro collectively is richer than most nations of the world. We have an annual income of more than $30 billion a year, which is more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. Did you know that? That power right there, if we know how to pull it. We don't have to argue with anybody. We don't have to curse and go around acting bad with our words. bricks and problems, we don't need any Molotov cocktails. We just need to go around to these stores and to these massive industries in our country and say, God sent us by here to say to you that you're not treating his children right. And we come by here to ask you to make the first item on your agenda fair treatment where God's children are concerned. Now, if you are not prepared to do that, we do have an agenda that we must follow. And our agenda calls for withdrawing economic support from you. So as a result of this, we're asking you tonight to go out and tell your neighbors not to buy Coca-Cola in Memphis. Go by and tell them not to buy sealed test milk. Tell them not to buy what is all the bread, Wonder Bread. And what is all the bread from the Jesse? Tell them not to buy hard bread. As Jesse Jackson has said, up to now, only the garbage men have been feeling pain. Now we must kind of redistribute the pain. We are choosing these companies because they have been paying their hiring policies, and we are choosing them because they can begin the process of saying they are going to support the needs and the rights of these men who are on strike, and then they can move on town, downtown, and tell Mayor Lowe to do what is right. And not only that, we've got to strengthen black institutions. I call upon you to take your money out of the bank downtown and deposit your money in Tri-State Bank. We want a bank in movement in Memphis. Go by the Savings and Loan Association. I'm not asking you something that we don't do ourselves in SCLC. Judge Hooks and others will tell you that we have an account here in the Savings and Loan Association from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. We are telling you to follow what we are doing. Put your money there. You have six or seven black insurance companies here in the city of Memphis. Take out your insurance there. We want to have an insurance in. Now, these are some practical things.
Open eyes that we may la loving peace.